So we want to talk to you today about self-control. And first of all, for those that listen to these talks remotely through podcasts and iTunes or through our website, you're welcome to correspond with us, give your comments, feedbacks at utahkrishnas@gmail.com. We also have a membership class online at our website at utahkrishnas.org. Everything is inspired by the teachings of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who's the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which has, I'm not sure, somewhere between 400 and 600 branches worldwide. Today we wanted to talk about self-control. Self-control is the ability to achieve control over your thoughts and your emotions in order to achieve a long-term goal. Self-controlled people make progress even when they're not in the mood, even when they don't feel like it. They make sure that they're always moving ahead. In the Bhagavad Gita, which is our scripture, there's an analogy made. The chariot that you see in this picture is compared to the body. The reins are compared to the mind. The intelligence is compared to the driver or the chauffeur, and the passenger is the soul. Now, imagine what happens to a chariot where the control is not exercised over the horses, and the horses can do whatever they want. Formula for disaster, isn't it? Sooner or later, it's going to go over a cliff. Probably sooner rather than later. But let's take a crude example also to show up the benefits if some measure of control is exercised. We all agree by consensus to drive on the right side of the road. Some days you may not feel like driving on the right side of the road. Sometimes you might get an impulse to cross the center line and drive on the left side of the road. But mostly we exercise a measure of control. If we couldn't count on everyone driving on the right side of the road, you couldn't even get from here to the freeway safely. But if everyone exercises a measure of control and drives on the right side of the road, there's no limits to where you can go. You can go to Florida, you can go to Canada, you can go to New York, you can go to California. So by exercising a measure of control, what have we achieved? We've achieved freedom. Now, self-control is not a very popular subject matter in today's day and age. Self-control is not very much in vogue in our see it, feel it, touch it, have it, possess it society. Self-control has a bad rap. It just means when someone talks about self-control, they're just going to talk about all the things that you can't do, the things that you can't eat, and the things that you can't say. But really, self-control and discipline are tools that God has given us in order to get freedom. In order to get freedom. And we need to make a decision whether we want to be controlled by our senses or whether we want to control our senses. Do we want to be controlled by those five horses running willy-nilly anywhere they want? Or do we want to tighten up the reins and with our intelligence take charge, literally take a grip and manage the whole rig and take it to wherever we want to go? We have the freedom to do that, to live a life of excellence, a life of direction, a life of purpose, a life which will bring us achievements and accomplishments and take us to places we never dreamed of. But we have to pay a little bit of a price, which is the price of exercising control. If we don't exercise control, then we're just guided by our senses. I don't think guided is probably the best word in this context. Misguided by our senses. Dragged by our senses, just in much the same way that the animals are. So self-control and discipline are not our enemies. God's given them these in order to achieve our goals in life. In a Back to Godhead, which is our monthly publication, a devotee named Rupa Nuga wrote, "We must decide whether to choose God and to love Him or not. And this is the choice of our lives. Krishna gives us the power to concentrate upon Him." Krishna is just our name for God. "If we choose not to think of Him, our minds continue out of control, lost in the impermanent flux of our desires." Now, how many people do you know, and maybe it applies to ourselves as well, that this describes? People that are out of control, lost in the impermanent flux of desires. Do you know people, or are you one of the people who are out of control in your spending? You're spending more than you make. Do you know, or are you one of those people who are out of control in your eating? Are you out of control in your attitudes, going around with a negative attitude, always complaining? Are you out of control in how you use your time? Instead of taking charge of your time, do you allow yourself and your time to be manipulated and usurped by other people? Are you or others that you know out of control in terms of your emotions going around always upset and very, very easily agitated at the slightest provocation. The root cause for all these things is a basic lack of discipline. And as soon as you try to exercise a little measure of control or discipline, the flesh or the senses will scream, "I can't take it. I want out. This is too much for me. Just let me have..." Before you do that, just let me have one more chocolate sundae. Before you do that, let's just watch one more episode of your favorite TV show on your lazy boy with a big gulp and a package of chips nearby. But a lot of people live that way. A lot of people live listening to that whisper of the flesh always in their ear. Now, got to do it now. Got to have it now. Got to consume it now. They go with their feelings without exercising any self-control. As soon as the flesh says, "Oh, it's too difficult, it's too much trouble, it's too painful," then they just cave in. Someone says, "Well, I know I should read the Bible or the Bhagavad Gita every day, but I don't have time for it. I know I should get up early in the morning, but I'm tired. I know I shouldn't spend more than I make, but I just got to have that new laptop. I just got to have that new thing that Macintosh has come out with, you know? It's too painful to break away from these things. I've got this set of friends that I've been hanging out with high school, and it's becoming more and more obvious that they're not going the place that I'm going. They're not destined to land up where I'm ending up, but I really don't want to take the trouble to break it up with them. I want to have it my way. I don't want to be inconvenienced or to pay the price. I want to take the easy way out." But any area in which you're not disciplined or regulated, it'll keep you from God's best for you. You may be undisciplined in a lot of areas. You may be disciplined in a lot of areas and only disciplined in one area. But whatever that is, whether it's your finance or your health or your relations or your mental attitude or your moods, whatever area it is in which we're not taking control, that's an area that's keeping us from God's best for us. So we need to exercise a little bit of discipline, even if it's going to cause discomfort. Some of you belong to health clubs and maybe a new machine appeared on the floor and you tried it out, and what happened the next day? You were sore. Why? Because you used muscles that you hadn't used before, isn't it? Isn't it? Up in our Salt Lake premise, where we tilled a garden, we rented a tiller, and we needed to get an elevated water supply to drip irrigate it, just like we do here. So we called in 7 dump truck loads of topsoil, and we spent 3 days arranging it and digging it with shovels. And the next day, I really felt that, because I haven't done that kind of work since I can't even remember when. So it may cause us a little discomfort to exercise some self-control. It may cause some soreness, but it's worth it. And in fact, if you felt that soreness, it's a good soreness. I mean, it's not really a negative thing. It's a good, good soreness, you know. I used to run regularly before I got tendonitis, and I wanted to be sore. Every day I wanted to be a little bit sore because it told me I was getting better. I was getting stronger. And I was able to go further and faster as a runner. And the soreness was a good sign. It was a good signal to me. Prabhupada said, these European and American boys were not accustomed to such a life. What is a life of a single person in Krishna consciousness? Well, they might have come from a mansion in Greenwich Hills, Greenwich Village, or Greenwich... What was that? What's that place in Connecticut? I forget what it's called. Huh? Greenwich, just Greenwich, yeah. Or Short Hills, New Jersey, or Shaker Heights in Chicago, or Beverly Hills. They might have lived and slept in mansions and had all kinds of servants at their disposal. But once they started practicing Krishna consciousness under the guidance of Prabhupada, they just slept on 6 feet of floor. And they kept all their belongings in a little bit of locker. And they were happy to do it. Because in fact, a simple, elevated life comes natural to us. Comes much more natural than an artificial life of impulsive consumerism. And if we get a little taste of it, and if we can practice a little bit, that lifestyle which takes us higher and higher and higher towards God is the most natural, satisfying lifestyle in the world. We wonder how we could have ever settled for anything less or gotten distracted. Examples given of a child, small little baby, really knows how to walk. I mean, we've got that instinctually in us. According to our philosophy, we've had hundreds, if not thousands, of previous incarnations, and we've always walked, whether it had been hooves or pads or two legs or four legs. We know how to walk. I mean, that's not an issue. We don't have to learn how to walk. We know how to walk. It's an instinct, but the child has to practice for some time. A few weeks of getting up and falling down, getting up and falling down. Then one day, the child gets up and he walks and everybody, "Oh, Johnny's walking! Come get in your car, come over and see Johnny walking," you know. But he didn't learn to walk, he just revived something that was already there. So love of God is in the heart of every living being. We're all lovers. We're all lovers. Everybody loves a lover, right? And ultimately, that love is most perfectly reposed in the source of everything. That person from whom everything comes. And so, even if it causes a little bit of a temporary discipline, discomfort, or a little bit of pain, it's worth it to get those muscles of self-control going to take us to a higher level. Now, here in a purport to the Bhagavad Gita verse, in the 13th chapter, 8th verse, Prabhupada writes, "Self-control means that one should not accept anything which is detrimental to the path of spiritual progress. The senses are so strong that they're always anxious to have sense gratification. The most important and uncontrollable sense is the tongue." Each sense is demanding to be satisfied. I want to see something, I want to smell something, I want to hear something. But the most demanding of all the senses is the sense of taste, or the tongue, which has two functions, to eat and to vibrate. If you can control these two functions of the tongue, eating in a higher way and speaking about higher subject matters, then you've achieved 60% of what we need to achieve in terms of self-control. And if you don't, the tongue will wreak havoc in one's life. 10 years ago, I remember reading in L.A., the sales of fast foods had surpassed the supermarket sales of food. What that meant to me was that people could no longer had the self-control to go to the supermarket to buy the produce, to take it home, to wash it, to cut it, and to prepare it and serve it for dinner. Because 10 years ago, I can't even imagine what it's like now. The more people, their tongue was saying, "I can't wait, I've got to have it now, take me to the nearest fast food window." Prabhupada said, "A tongue out of control will eat any damn thing." Pardon me. "And a tongue out of control will talk about any nonsensical subject matter." So we aspire to control the tongue, but that doesn't mean to stop speaking and to stop eating. Our process of bhakti yoga involves eating only purified vegetarian food which has been offered to Krishna first. And you'll see that little plate on the altar with the cloth over it. Prema just brought it up a few minutes ago. He cooked everything with God in mind. Everything comes from God, and so he has the first right of enjoyment. Now, he doesn't have to eat, you know, material food. He doesn't have to come down and chomp it. But he enjoys the love, the devotion, and the intelligence with which we offer that food to him. And the process of offering is a kind of a meditation. And when we make a vow to eat only food which has been offered to God, guess what? Our sense of tasting, our tongue, gets under control. We don't stop eating, but we eat at regular times. There are regular times when the offerings are made. And after the offerings come out for the altar, then we can eat those sumptuous foodstuffs. So that automatically regulates our life. It automatically makes us vegetarian, and it adds another intangible ingredient, which is the ingredient of devotion, into the food. Thus, the tongue is controlled. We don't stop speaking. We don't stop speaking, but we speak about God. We speak about higher philosophical, theological subject matters. So this is not a process of repression. It's not a process of repression. Does anyone feel sensually deprived here? Right? Beautiful sights, the smell of incense and flowers, the scent of cooking coming from downstairs. In about 20, 25, 30 minutes, we'll all go down and enjoy a vegetarian feast together. So the flesh is not really screaming out, like, "I can't take this," in our very easy, practical process of transcendence. And yet we have taken charge. We have gotten a grip. We're not being led around by our feelings. and our senses. We have a plan, and that plan is to purify our consciousness and to approach the supreme pure who is God. There's a saying that if you want to mix with fire, you have to become like fire. So if you want to know God and experience the most that there is to experience in life, you want to start with self-control and self-purification. And you can feel, as you get more and more purified, you can feel yourself becoming more holy, more purified, more sublime, and closer to God. Example is given, you might be hungry. You might be hungry. But every morsel of food that you eat, you achieve a measure of self-control, don't you? Right? There's no more effective way of controlling your hunger than to eat something nice, isn't it? And every morsel that you eat, you might be able to say you're controlling your hunger more, right? So the way of dealing with the whimsy of the senses is not to repress them, but to give them something better. Then they're satisfied. Then the flesh is not screaming out in protest. So have a plan and stick to your plan. Will reading this book progress me in my plan? Will eating this food progress me in my plan? Will seeing this movie progress me in my plan? Will hanging around with these people further me in my plan or not? Make a plan and stick to it. And again, it's not of repression. A snake charmer had a snake that was unruly, and he thought he would subdue the snake by putting the lid on the basket and keeping the snake in a contained space for a number of days. And his expectation is that when he would remove the lid, the snake would then be docile, having been taught a lesson. What do you think happened? Whenever, after 3 or 4 days, when he took that lid, that snake went pong, like that. He got bit. So trying to repress the senses is artificial, and it will rebound on you. The senses will come back twice as strongly in the end. And the Bhagavad Gita says, that which is like poison in the beginning is like nectar in the end. That which is like nectar in the beginning is like poison in the end. So it may hurt a little bit, it may be a little painful to regulate one's life, like getting up early in the morning. We have Mangal Arati. Here we're not as controlled as they are in other temples. We have our early morning ceremony at 6. Most temples have their early morning ceremony at 4:30 or 5. And the first time that I went to such an early morning ceremony, about 42 years ago, I thought I'd drunk poison. I said, what have I gotten myself into? I'd rather be in boot camp in the Marines, you know. And yet very, very quickly, with a little bit of practice, it came natural. Early to bed, early to rise makes you healthy, wealthy, and wise. So as you feel the health, as you feel the wisdom, as you feel the contentment and health, you get addicted to it. And you no longer want to stay up watching Letterman. You'd rather go to bed early, skip Letterman, and get up and get the Gita. And that happens very, very quickly. And honestly, once you have a taste for it, getting up in the morning, showering, appearing in the temple room, singing and dancing and seeing the beautiful forms of the Lord, you wouldn't want it any other way, and you wouldn't want to start your day any other way. On the other hand, that which is like nectar in the beginning is like poison in the end. You know, these people in their pajamas, you know, they're in the first thing they do when they get up is they go, they can't even take a shower first or put on a pair of pants, right? They walk out the door in their pajamas and their BO and everything, and they pick up the newspaper. You know, or maybe you don't subscribe to the newspaper anymore. Maybe the first thing you do is you check your email, right? Before you've even showered, and then you have a double latte, and maybe you drag yourself off to work. You know, well, that all might be, you know, immediately gratificatory, but in the end, it's just like poison. You don't get anything valuable or profitable from having spent one's time in that way. We're going to have pain in life. We've got these material bodies. We live in the material world. You cannot avoid pain. Pain is inevitable. But you can choose either the pain of short-term self-control, the pain of discipline, which actually is a good feeling in most cases, or the pain of regret. It's a choice between ounces of pain versus tons of pain. And I don't want to make anyone feel bad about their past. We've all made bad choices, and we've probably as recently as yesterday, or maybe as recently as an hour ago on the way here. But we do want to stir ourselves up a little bit and get us thinking about the right course, about paying the price that we need to pay in order to be a little bit disciplined, which is a minute price to pay compared to a lifetime of regret over time wasted and misspent. Believe me, you'd rather pay those ounces of pain now than the tons of pain later. You would like to reach the autumn of your years, about my age, 50 or 60, and you would like to look back and be so happy that you didn't do that or that you did do that. So very, very happy and ecstatic without any regrets whatsoever. So when you get that little whisper of the voice in your ear, do that, enjoy that, consume that. Don't let that little whisper in your ear convince you that you can't change. Krishna or God wants that change to take place. He's constructed us in such a way that we can quite happily exercise discipline. And when we say no to the cookie jar, or we say no to the hot fudge sundae, or when we say yes to a morning walk or a jog, or no to the white sugar, or whatever it may be, or no to this bad relationship which isn't leading me anywhere, or no to this credit card expenditure which I can't afford. When we do our part, God does His part. And we tap into a supernatural power. If you just learn to say a couple of small no's in areas that you would have been dragged or without thinking said yes, you'll experience that God's assistance will kick in, that God's in the stands there cheering you on. And then you have access to a supernatural power which will enable you to do things and to give up some things and to accept other things that you would have never been able to do on your own. Prabhupada says here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, thus being fixed, one must render service unto the super soul situated in one's heart by his omnipotency. Because he is the almighty personality of God, and eternal and unlimited. He is the ultimate goal of life, and by worshipping him, one can end the cause of the conditioned state of material existence. Just think about it. The almighty, supreme personality of Godhead, who created millions and millions and millions of universes, who lives in a world remote and far removed from this material world, has also, by his omnipotency, entered into the hearts of each and every living being. So that same Lord, who is at one and the same time in the spiritual world, is within every living being's heart. And we can tap into that supernatural power with just a little bit of self-restraint. Now, I'm talking about self-restraint. I hope you're not getting a negative impression, because eating sumptuous vegetarian food that's offered to Krishna is not exactly painful. Singing and dancing and glorify the Lord in the company of like-minded people is not exactly harsh. Getting up in the early in the morning is not the worst thing in the world. What we're really talking about here is not so much pain or discomfort. We're just talking about regulation. We're talking about regulating our life. And an unregulated lifestyle in this age is the cause of dissatisfaction, confusion, depression, short-livedness, and so. So if you just begin to regulate your life according to the with the Lord in the center, then that's all the really austerities that one needs to do. And it doesn't matter how long you've had bad habits or how long you've had a bad attitude. The power of the Lord is unlimited. The power of the Lord is more than enough to counteract a bad attitude. The power of the Lord is more than enough to negate addictions that you might have. The power of the Lord is more than enough to bring your spending back under control and reduce your debt. The power of the Lord is more than enough to counteract a lazy spirit and get you up and get you going, if you'll simply tap into that. What am I saying? Let's stop making excuses. Let's make a start here for us to go higher. For us to go higher, the flesh, the feelings, the senses, they have to go a little bit lower. Someone says, well, I think that's a good message. And when I sold cookies in Southern California to raise money for this temple, I would go to Southern California in the winter when it was too cold. And I would stand outside at the exit door of Kmart and Walmart and do like a bake sale. So a lot of people had this joke. A lot of people have this joke. They would buy some cookies and all, and they'd say, I've been meaning to start a diet, but my astrologer said the best day to start a diet is tomorrow. So I'm going to eat a lot of cookies today. Now is the time. No more excuses. Have you ever heard someone make an excuse for their hot-bloodedness because they're Italian? Have you ever heard that, right? right? Or their lustiness because they're a Latin, right? Have you ever heard a woman rationalize overspending because, well, I'm a woman and that's what women do? You ever heard that? Have you ever heard anyone make an excuse about overeating because, well, my father overeats, my mother overeats, my grand... It's in our genes. It's in our genes. We can't help it. But just know that any area of your life in which you're undisciplined is an area in which you're just not going forward. If you're not willing to make the effort or pay the price, you're not going to get the maturity that's there for you to have. I told this story a couple weeks ago. I think it's still appropriate for this theme. I went to the University of Virginia, and this would be 1966. We had a football team, the Cavaliers, and there were two quarterbacks, one of whom was brilliant, an absolute brilliant athlete. He could throw the football 90 yards. He could run downfield 80 yards. He could jump over tacklers. But the problem was he was undisciplined. Most of the time, the team didn't know what he was doing. He didn't follow the game plan. He didn't follow the playbook. He was out grandstanding, and nobody knew what he was doing. I don't think he even knew what he was doing most of the time. So he'd either make a brilliant play or he'd make a spectacular botch of the whole thing. The other quarterback, his name was Hodges, wasn't in the least bit talented or athletic. I mean, he was somewhat athletic, but he didn't have the star power as this other fellow. But he was very disciplined, very disciplined. He didn't force the ball between receivers or defenders. He didn't step out of the pocket to pass. He was very, very disciplined, and he was the one that saw all the playing time and not the brilliant person. The word discipline comes from disciple. And disciple comes from the Sanskrit word sishyas. And this means the first step in achieving discipline and being inspired and motivated for discipline is to attach yourself to someone who is already disciplined in that way. To find someone who is only eating food offered to the Lord, who is only talking about the Lord, whose lifestyle is rise early and glorify the Lord, who's made the Lord the center of their life. And if you find such a person and you can hear from them and you can eat with them and you can serve them, even doing menial tasks, then you're going to achieve the same excellence that they have by association. So the path of perfection was inaugurated in our tradition by associating with a bona fide spiritual master, a pure devotee of the Lord. And a bona fide spiritual master would show his grace on young aspirants by accepting them as a disciple. The place where the spiritual master lived would be called the Gurukul, or the place of the Guru. And even sons of kings and sons of rich men, when they would come to live at the ashram of the Guru, they would not be given any special treatment. In fact, they would be sent out every day with their bowl into the village to beg, say, can you give some rice for me to take it back to my Guru's ashram? Now, what happens when you go out begging? What happens? What happens? A lot of people say no, isn't it? And they don't always say it nicely either. Now, what's your impulse? What's your first feeling? What would you normally do? Say something back, right? They lash out at you, you say something back. But you can't do that. You have to learn self-control. And in this way, sons of kings and sons of rich men, by the process of doing menial service to the Guru, they learn to put their feelings in check. They learn self-control and humility. So later on, when they became the kings or they became the leaders of society, they had the most important quality, which is not to react, not to be reactive, but to be proactive, to keep their feelings in check and not be enslaved by them. Prabhupada, our guru, just as an aside, he was born in 1896 in Calcutta of devotee parents. Never in his life, there are four principles that he asked all of his sishyas or disciples to follow. No illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, no meat-eating. Was that too fast for you? Well, if you're LDS, it's three, no illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication. And then if you're LDS, just one more, no meat-eating. Now, he never touched any of those in his life. Not once in his life did he ever eat meat or smoke a cigarette or drink a cup of tea or have illicit sex or gamble. In fact, when he was 3 years old, one time he got deathly ill. And the doctor said to his father, if you don't give him chicken soup, he'll die. And the father resisted, but the doctor, you know, browbeat him, scared him. So finally, he didn't have anything like that in the house, never would, never will. But they sent from down the street someone to bring some chicken soup. And the first teaspoon they put into the mouth of the street, he just spewed it out all over everybody. Now, Prabhupada came in 1965, 7-year-old man with no money, and basically a message of self-control and discipline. Basically a message that if you can exercise a little self-control and discipline, you're releasing the favor of the Lord to take you to places you could never even imagine. And because he was in that place, you couldn't see him or hear him or spend 5 minutes without realizing that he was already in that place and you wanted it like anything. So 5,000 young people, and myself included, in a time when people were taking LSD, according to the advice of a Harvard professor, they were smoking marijuana and they had free love, 5,000 young people became his disciples and agreed to give up illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling for the rest of their life. Simply that they could have what he had. The freedom, the favor of the Lord, the destiny. This principle is so foundational in our culture that when Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, came to the earth 5,000 years ago, while he was exhibiting his childhood pastimes, he himself went and lived in the ashram, in the Gurukul of Sandipani Muni. And even though he was God, he did menial services on behalf of his guru. You know the story of him and Sudama being sent out to gather firewood. A storm came, they got lost, and they spent the night in the woods. God himself did this. One time a man, a very wealthy man, he called a gardener, landscape company, and he said, I've got a big backyard, several acres, and I'm willing to spend tens of thousands of dollars to get exotic trees and flowers and fruits and grasses in there. I just have one condition, that all this be maintenance free. And then the gardener started laughing. He said, You got to be joking. There's no such thing as a maintenance free garden. You have to tend it, you have to cultivate it in order to get the results. So similarly, God has planted a garden in each and every one of us. It's called the Bhakti Lata Bij. It's the seed of love of God, the devotional creeper. It's not going to grow by itself. We have to tend it. We have to cultivate it. We have to pull out the weeds of material desires, the weeds of feelings and sentiments and emotions, and put them under control. We have to fence it against bad association and those would trample the tender creeper. We have to water it. And the way that we water the creeper of devotion is by chanting the names of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And if we do all this, that creeper germinates, fructifies, it becomes a plant, it becomes a tree, and ultimately it produces the fruits of the Spirit. Now, you've seen people walk with favor, with prosperity, with contentment, with peace, with compassion. And you've said, I wish I could have their blessings. I wish I could walk in their footsteps. I wish I could walk in their favor. But what we might be missing is it didn't come automatically. It didn't come automatically. They tended their gardens. If you go back in time, there were instances when they did things they didn't feel like doing them, but they did them because they were right. Analogously, out there in the sun, when it was uncomfortable taking care of the garden. Out there in all kinds of seasons when you didn't feel like it, but you took care of the garden. And now, fast forward, they're enjoying the fruits of that cultivation. And what are those fruits if we take care of our garden? What are the fruits of the Spirit? Love, peace, gentleness, patience, goodness, faithfulness, kindness, joy, and self-control. Wherever you see a self-controlled person, you'll see a person who is gentle, patient, who is good and kind. Just as much as soon as one fruit of the tree matures, it's safe to assume that the other fruits have also matured. So if we exercise this principle of self-control, then we'll achieve spiritual maturity and we'll enjoy all these various fruits of the Spirit. Otherwise, without self-control, eat 25 bowls of ice cream, we'll tell someone off. Have you ever heard anyone say, I just tell it like it is, man. I just tell it like it is. Let the cards fall where they may. You know? Well, you're just an idiot. You need to learn to bite your tongue in the interest of peace and harmony. And if you want to say something, say it with tenderness. Say it with tenderness. Be tender without surrender. Someone living according to their feelings, why should we even get up in the morning? You know, it feels good to lie in bed. Why should I get up, go to work, pay my taxes? Why shouldn't I spend money I don't have? If I can do it, then why shouldn't I do it? But the reason that we exercise freedom and discipline and self-control is because it frees us from the tyranny of the senses. It frees us from the unending demands of the senses, which are like a fire. It's like a fire. And catering to them, caving into them, is like trying to put out a fire by pouring gasoline on it. Oh, I'm so hungry, I could eat a horse. All right? So you eat, and then 6 hours later you want to eat again. And you want to eat again. You know these eating contests, you know, where the guys eat and they win, there's big cash money now. Yeah, you would think that they would prepare for these eating contests by fasting and they would get hungry. But no, when the contest is coming up, they eat more and more and more and more and more and more and more because it makes them a bigger appetite. So when is lust satisfied? When are your feelings and when are your emotions going to say, okay, you've served me enough, you've groveled in the dirt at the crack of my whip, now I free you, I give a pension, here's a gold watch, and go live in peace. Right? Right? I had some friends recently went to India and they came back and they'd been to the Taj Mahal and they were talking how beautiful it was and how gorgeous it was and how the sun went down and so on and so forth. And I asked them, I said, well, would you go back again? And they said, nah, I don't think so. I think once was enough. Nobody ever said that about sex. Have you ever heard anyone say that about sex? So following the senses, being enslaved by the senses, is neither pensionable nor terminable. It never ends. And when someone's a slave, they're forced to do things that they wouldn't wish to do. They're forced to do things that are against their interest. In our modern society, almost everything is permissible, but not everything is profitable. And the ability to discern between that which is permissible and profitable is the dividing line between leading a mediocre, average life and a life of excellence. It's a dividing line between getting by and getting along and living a life of victory, seeing your dreams come true. We can get by, we can get along. You know, you can pop pills to get up in the morning, you can pop pills to go to sleep at night. You can get along. Of course, eventually, love will die, your spouse will become distant, your kids will lose respect for you. But you can get along. You can get along with flashing the credit card and the results won't come maybe for years and years and years and years. You can just tuck your head down and get in the crowd and just be like everyone else. But you will have missed God's purpose for you. You'll have missed the higher destiny. Everything is permissible, but not everything is profitable. So maybe, you know, maybe we need to think more seriously and do something today. After all, I was inspired to give this message today. So it might be today's the day to do a little discipline in one's life and not put it off till tomorrow. And maybe you are a disciplined person, but there might be an area in your life in which you're not disciplined that you need to work on. And in that area, the lack of discipline is keeping you from God's higher purpose for you. So we need to be more disciplined, some of us, in choosing our friends because they're not going where we are going. We need to be disciplined, some of us, in our thought life and learn to repattern our thinking to be more positive and less negative. Some of us need to be more disciplined in how we choose our words and how we approach people. Of course, some of us need to be more disciplined in our finances, and some of us need to be more disciplined in how we spend our time. Because in any area that we're not disciplined, our growth will be stunted. So finally, in conclusion, I'd like to challenge you and myself today to start exercising some self-control. There's not going to be any more convenient time than now. It may be a little difficult, a little painful at first, but the pain of discipline is nothing compared to the pain of regret. You're the gardener of your own life. Krishna wants to take you to a higher level. Self-discipline is a dividing line between excellence and mediocrity. If you'll take charge and be disciplined in your thoughts, words, emotions, Krishna or God will take you to a place that you never dreamed of. And if you will with me, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.